So this Thursday, this Wednesday, I had this scoop of hearing a shiur from Rav Moshe Lichtenstein during lunch. He decided to talk about the Haggadah. And, you know, I happened to be preparing a shiur on the Prince of Egypt at the time, and I happened to be working through his Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's book, Moses. And how great would it have been if Rav Moshe Lichtenstein started talking about the Prince of Egypt in his shiur as I was preparing the shiur for today? Well, he did. It was incredible. It was really like a passing remark where he basically said something along the lines of, I don't think the people in Egypt had such great voices back then like they made out in the movie. Just everybody here has seen the movie, right? That's important. Otherwise, get, Chaim. Okay. Either way. Basically, what he said was that the movie kind of got it wrong in the sense that the movie's filled with music, and he said Mitzrayim was a pretty dreary place. Okay, not really a shock point, but in general, an interesting point to make. He was making his observation that in certain areas, the movie didn't exactly get the story right. Now, what's interesting, I did a little research before giving this year into actually what type of biblical research was done in terms of the making of the movie, The Prince of Egypt. And it appears that in 1998, when the director decided to cast this film, he actually was very, very conscious of the fact that he was making a film, a biblical film, that could really cause an uproar if it wasn't done correctly. So he had over 500 different theologians and religious people from three main faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, preview the movie to kind of give it the okay. Everybody gave it the okay. In fact, one of those people who sat in those audiences was Rabbi Sachs, whom I've also heard Pshatim on The Prince of Egypt from earlier on in the semester, but those I'll share later on. So just to kind of whet your appetite, there was much forethought that went into the making of The Prince of Egypt in terms of at least kind of trying to create some type of true biblical narrative in the actual movie itself. I find it fascinating every time I watch The Prince of Egypt, which of course is every night, okay, maybe like this is my second time, that at the very beginning of the movie, there's a little caption that reads as follows. Like before anything happens, it says, "This motion picture you are about to see is an adaptation of the Exodus story. Artistic and historical license have been taken. We believe that we have tried to stay true to the essence of the values and integrity of the story that is the cornerstone of the faith for millions of people worldwide." So basically they say, we tried to stay as close to the shot as possible, and then the line right after that, for those who are clueless, reads as follows, "By the way, Moses can be found in Exodus." Okay, very cute. And with that, we begin the more serious components of our shiur. When I was watching the Exodus, The Prince of Egypt, I was watching it with this prism of thought in mind, trying to find distinctions between the actual narrative and the story presented in the movie. And I thought, what better way to do this than to read a parallel narrative at the same time? So that parallel narrative that I read was the book of Rav Moshe Lichtenstein on the character of Moses. So basically what we're going to do in the forthcoming shiur is as follows. We're going to kind of march our way through the story presented to the Prince of Egypt, use it as a template towards understanding the story that was presented in The Prince of Egypt, and ask whether that story actually got the pshat right or not. And when we ask that question, we're going to kind of jump to Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's pshat on the same issues to see how he made the narrative. So basically, Tamsi Takol, what we're going to try to do is we're going to develop two narratives. We're going to develop the Prince of Egypt narrative, and we're going to develop the Rav Moshe Lichtenstein narrative. And through this, hopefully we'll get some insight into the concept of pshat and midrash. Now, before we actually start marching through the narrative, I want to give some examples of, I guess, categories of of Pshat and Midrash that can be found within the text of that can be found in the movie Prince of Egypt, and will kind of help form our thought for the forthcoming shiur. I'll start with one of the first scenes in the movie. One of the first scenes in the movie is you see the Egyptians chasing the Jews, throwing babies in the river, and you see Yocheved running with the young Miriam and Aharon with the little baby in her hand, putting a Moshe, a little baby Moshe, in the river at the age of 3 months old. He's crying, the singing is obviously beautiful, and he kind of pushes the teva with Moshe in it down into the stream, and what ensues is total chaos. You see Moshe in the teva kind of being swept up by waves, and hippopotamuses kind of like are like jumping around, and they're like oars of boats are knocking the teva back and forth, and like you're thinking the entire time, there's no way this baby is going to make it anywhere alive. This teva is going to be overturned, right? Baby Moshe is not going to make it anywhere. And obviously we know what happens in the movie. Teva ends up making it to Batya, Bat Paro, who in the movie is the wife of Paro. First thing I thought when I saw that was, well, that's incredible. I wonder if that's what actually happened in the Torah. So, took a look, and this is the part where we start the interaction part. At Perek Bet, Pasuk, Gimel, and Dalet. And after reading it, actually, let me hear your thoughts. What do you think? Pesukim Gimel and Dalet. Perek Bet, Pasuk Gimel and Dalet. Does it seem like the Teva even moved? What?
Doesn't say
it. So, yeah, this exactly, when I read the text, and it seemed like what happened was the teva was put basuf, mm-hmm, by the reeds, and it kind of just waited there. And in fact, it almost looks like Yocheved and Miriam were plotting to have something like this happen, because if you look at Pasuk Dalet, it says, V'teitzev achotom erachot, the sister stood from afar, L'de'a ma ye'aselo. Now, I'm not a grammarian, but ma ye'aselo doesn't seem like something that nature will do to it, but something that human beings will do to it. I may be wrong on this one, but what that made me believe was that, in fact, what happened here was Yocheved and Miriam had kind of planted Moshe by the house of Paro. Right? Yeah, go for it.
Even the fact that she's able to stand stationary and watch what's going to happen implies that it's not moving in the water, because then she'd have to be...
Right. Okay. Even,
so
even
that more than just the passive voice. The passive voice is used...
Also, but like, if you think about it, just like, why would she just put her kid into the river to like, was she just casting him off, saying what will happen, or is there actually like a plan here? Why is this any different than trying to hide Moshe in the house for longer, trying to keep him from the midstream? Yeah.
Because she was doing exactly what Paro said: place your baby into the river. But she did it in a way.
In a teva.
Yeah.
To save him. I don't know. I'm no teta to what everybody else is saying in the room. But I think this is point number one in terms of watching the movie and what it helped me do. This was a sample of the movie helping me clarify the pshat. I mean, the movie didn't do it. The movie presented a whacked out narrative. Then I read the text again closely, and it helped me clarify the pshat of what was actually happening. And I think that really is pshat. Another point in the movie, this happens much later on. We're going to skip to like towards the end of Shemot. Towards the end, towards Makat Bechorot. What happens is Paro gets very angry at Moshe, and he yells out to Moshe, right, in this like rage of frustration, and there shall be a great cry in Egypt such as there has never been, and there will never be again. Paro says this to Moshe. Does that pasuk sound familiar to you? If you look at Shemot Yud Aleph Pasuk Vav, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Vav, you see it? V'hayta tzaka gdola b'chol eretz Mitzrayim asher kamo lo nihayta v'chamo lo tosif. But what's different about the context of this pasuk? Who's saying it?
The difference.
The narrator.
The narrator. God, Moshe, whoever wrote it. but it's not Paro. So what fascinated me here, and this pasuk has always thrown me off, right? Like, why is it this great cry? This has never been a cry beforehand. It's always sounded like it was responding to something, like it's responding to some previous cry that there was, right? Because there's something relative going on here. And when I read, when I saw the movie and I saw Paro yelling out, right, these same lines, I said, well, there may actually be something there. Now, there's no way of clarifying whether this is actually the backdrop and whether the narrator here in the text is responding to a statement that Paro said, but in a way, it was having me read the psukim with a little bit more carefulness towards maybe an added backdrop, which I was unaware of. So those are two forms of pshat in a text. This is taking longer than I thought. That's okay. So we have the teva, and we have that. After Moshe Rabbeinu finds out about his real Jewish identity in the Prince of Egypt, he has like this whole identity crisis, and at a certain point, he's kind of, there's a scene where he's sitting by the river where his mother had previously picked him up. And his mother kind of comes up behind him, his mother meaning the Queen of Egypt at the time. And Moshe turns to the Queen of Egypt and says, why did you save me? Right? And the Queen of Egypt responds as follows, you were a gift from the gods. Now this is where we kind of make our way into Drash. Question that's always nagged me, and I think it's kind of been in the back of everybody's head, is if Paro makes a decree to kill all the Jews of Egypt, all the young baby boys that are born, and then all of a sudden a baby shows up at your doorstep or your water step or whatever it is, why do you decide to save that child? Why did Bat Paro decide to save the child? And why would Paro agree to it? Was Moshe hidden? Potentially. In a way, the movie was responding to a question which Pshat couldn't really respond to, but in a way, the purpose of Midrash is to answer those questions. Why was Moshe saved, even though he was a 3-month-old child? Because the Queen of Egypt thought he was a gift from God. And I think there's textual support from this, but you can't say bevada'ut. The words kimina mayim mishitihu, right? Because I drew you out from the water, may imply something miraculous. In fact, I once heard from Aaron Kohler that the very words in Moshe may actually just be a shortened form of the longer name Ramses, like Ra, Moshe, and that he may be named after God, or God that saved him, and then in a way, the very naming of Moshe, the reason we may even keep that name of Moshe is because it's indicative of the very reason that Moshe was saved. Moshe was saved because the Queen of Egypt and the King of Egypt thought that he was a gift of God. Little do they know, maybe he was a gift to God, but to different people. Okay. The last point in Drash world is when Moshe is already in Midian, and I'm skipping parts of it, but we're going to do the narrative in order at a certain point. But Moshe is already in Midian, and he's wandering around the sheep, and one of the sheep wanders off, and he follows that sheep, and there he finds the snet. That's what happens to the Prince of Egypt. Now, we'll get to it. There's a lot. There's so much. Now I ask myself, why did the Prince of Egypt do that? Like, that doesn't happen in the actual text, but it's one of those stories that we've all heard from the time we were 5 years old, that like, oh, Moshe wandered after the sheep and found the snet. And with that I realized that the reason that that part was incorporated into the Prince of Egypt narrative, even though it's not part of the actual biblical text, is because there's kind of a gap in the actual biblical narrative that had to be filled in. So they reach towards a story with a sheep, right? Moshe following a sheep to fill in this loose end to teach us how Moshe made it to the snet. So altogether, I think we have four categories right here. Two pshat ones and two midrash ones that we kind of learned out of the Prince of Egypt. We have Shot just helping clarify the text when there's another wacky narrative. We have number two, realizing that there may be added nuance or backdrop to the text. That was, you know, the cry in Egypt being never being that bad beforehand. We have the Midrash, in the Midrash world, those nagging questions that are in the back of our head whenever we read a text that we don't have an answer to, and the Midrash kind of comes in to answer, such as the question of, you know, why was Moshe saved? And number four, certain times there are gaps in the narrative, and that may be what Midrash does to fill it in. Two Pshat, two Midrash.
Okay.
Now what we're going to do with those categories is kind of just file them away in the back of our brain and progress through the actual Prince of Egypt narrative and Moses narrative that Rav Moshe Lichtenstein portrays, and kind of constantly ask the same question of how does the Prince of Egypt portray it, and is that really Pshat? What does that teach us? So with that, I'm going to kind of outline Moshe's youth. In Prince of Egypt, the following is what happens. Moshe is incredibly unaware of his identity. He doesn't seem to know that he's Jewish. When does he become aware of his identity? Chester McHugh. When?
Wait, are you talking about Prince of Egypt?
Prince of Egypt. When does Moshe remember that he's Jewish?
When he's confronted by his brother and sister.
Yeah, and even more so.
He's reading on the wall.
It's a combination. It's all the same movie.
No, that's only when he runs back to... No, because he was running after Sipora. Okay, because I also just thought he's running after Sipora, and then he was brought into like the Jewish section, and he sees Aaron and Miriam. They're like, oh brother, we always knew you would return to us. And then he like casts them off, and he runs into the temple or whatever, and he sees the painting.
Okay, so there's one. Actually, I think the point where Moshe turns around is when Miriam sings the lullaby that Yochaved had sung to him beforehand years back.
Yeah.
And then, all of a sudden, something triggers in his mind.
Yeah,
he remembers his childhood from his 3 months old. He runs back. He has this whole story, this whole long song about how this is a home he grew up in, and this is the only thing he ever wanted. And now, everything's being turned on his head, and he runs in, he sees the hieroglyphics, and he sees the stories of he sees on the wall the hieroglyphics showing babies being thrown into alligators' mouths, and then Paro at the time comes and puts his hand on Moshe's shoulder and says, sometimes you have to make sacrifices for the good of the kingdom. Moshe says, why? And Paro says, well, they were only slaves.
Right.
Okay? And at this point, Moshe is kind of in a tumult, doesn't know what's going on, and doesn't really know who he is, because he, the entire time, the person that he used to call father, right, he now realizes it wasn't his father. I'm trying to quote the movie as much as I possibly can. Now, let's take a look at the actual text and see what the actual narrative tells us. Did Moshe know he was Jewish? Starting from Perek Bet, Pasuk Chet. Did Moshe know he was Jewish?
It seems like we don't know if he knew that he was Jewish, but he knew that like he was growing up with his biological mother, meaning like we'd be safe to presume that like he did, you know, she did tell him that he was Jewish.
So,
but it says v'gidel yaled v'tavo lebatkara, meaning like he didn't grow up with batkara, he grew up with the mother, with Yochel.
So there's a machlokah and a mefarshim. I can't remember who is who, but there's a question on this issue, because what happens is right after Bat Paro finds Moshe, what goes to call for the mother of the child to nurse him, and then the psukim tell us Vatikach Aisha Yelad Vatinikehu, the mother of the child came and nursed him. Then Vayigdal HaYelad, then the child grew up. The question is, at what point did he grow up, right? Did he grow up after he was weaned at the age of 2, or did he grow up 15 years later? At what point is he brought to the palace? Vativiehu levat paro, vayihila leven, vatikra shemo Moshe, vatomer kimina mayim yishitehu. It's questionable, but the next thing I would pose to you, if you were to make the claim that Moshe didn't know that he was Jewish, would be as follows. Look at the next pasuk. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayehi bayamim ahem, vayigdal Moshe vayetzei el achav, vayar besivlotam. At what point does Moshe find out that the people working outside are his brothers? There must have been a point where Moshe became aware of the fact that slaves in Egypt were his own, where they were his family. And I would argue that I think the pshat of the text is that Moshe knew from a very young age that he was Jewish. He was just raised in the house of Paro. He's privileged.
And it seems that he goes out, like, it doesn't say like he realizes there's no point of like realization. There's no epiphany in Pasuk Yud Aleph. He just goes out and like there's either an instinctual or a like presumption that they're his brothers. It's not like, you know, and he realized that they were his brothers. He went out to his brothers. The brothers were already there, and brothers from the nation. And, you know, that's what he went out to.
Right. I hear that. And just to kind of go tread along what you were saying, if you look at the psukim, the word vayigdal is used again, as it was used beforehand, but I think here vayigdal means something very different. And understanding what that vayigdal means could actually affect the entire reading of the narrative. I think vayigdal, in Pasuk Yud, vayigdal hayelad means, you know, he grew up in the sense that he was mature enough to live in the palace. However, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, I think vayigdal means that he matured to the point where when he went outside, now he didn't just look at the people outside as stam slaves, but he realized that he had to do something about it. The maturity was one of like a moral maturing, where he realized that he had to help his brothers. And I think this is points like a major chiluk between how everything develops in the Prince of Egypt and how it develops here. And this is where Moshe Lichtenstein's narrative comes in. Okay, in the Prince of Egypt, it's Moshe's having an identity crisis. He just finds out that the people are Jewish, that he belongs to Jewish people. The next day he goes out to watch people working, and then in like the tumult of everything, he sees one Jew being whipped. So without thinking at all, like totally rationally, he goes and he confronts the Egyptian man and pushes him off this high tower, and he ends up dying. And then in the midst of all of this, out of his fear and his identity crisis, and after murdering somebody, Moshe just runs away. There's nothing extremely rational about the decision to push somebody, to push the man off of the cliff. If you look at the actual narrative, and this is what Moshe Lichtenstein does, I'm not going to totally flesh it out, but it's very cool. He says that Moshe here was actually leading his first attempt to bring the Jews out of Mitzrayim. That Moshe had matured within the palace of Paro. Vayar besivlotam. He saw not something physical, he saw their anguish. He was able to see the pain, right? The Bnei Israel were suffering under. And on this one day, he decided to go out and take the first act. It's like a Matisyahu motion. He killed the first person and he started the rebellion. He pushed somebody off, right? He pushed Mitzri off, and he thought this would be the rallying cause around which all of Bnei Israel would come and start the rebellion. This is when Yitzhak Mitzrayim would begin. And Rav Moshe goes on to say, if you look at Pasuk Yigimel, the Pasuk Yigimel says, Vayetze Bayom HaSheni. Vayetze Bayom HaSheni implies what? A connection to Yom Rishon. And generally we view all of them, these Moshe narratives as, oh, one day, you know, Moshe went out and killed the Mitzri, another day he saw Jews fighting, without any really connection to the two, and then the Jews ended up bringing up the fact that Moshe had killed the Mitzri. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein says differently. He says, Vayetze Bayom HaSheni, he came out on the second day, expecting all the Jews to rally behind his cause, but instead, what does he find? He finds them fighting. Rav Moshe starts darshaning, well, maybe they're fighting over whether to join Moshe or not. But Moshe here, Moshe Rabbeinu, is, you have to distinguish, Moshe Rabbeinu is disappointed by seeing the Jews fighting, sees that they don't really have it in them to rebel, and his grassroots movement against Paro, which was supposed to start the day beforehand, isn't really going to work. And in his frustration, and now with the bounty on his head, because Paro knows that Moshe isn't with him but against him, Moshe leaves to Midian. Next question. Does Moshe go to Midian just to escape? Is it just the place he ends up? Or does Moshe go to Midian bidavka? Does Moshe want to be in Midian? In the Prince of Egypt, what happens is he's just kind of wandering, like there's a sandstorm, his head ends up under the ground, the camel ends up trying to chew on his hair to pull him out of the ground, and then he somehow makes his way to Midian. If you look at the text, and this is where Moshe Lichtenstein argues, it seems like Moshe Davka wanted to go to Midian. Because there, he could find one person who thought he could really connect with. A role model. What was his name? Yitro, Kohen Midian. I'm not going to read through the entire text now, but if you look at it, it seems like the stress of these psukim is Moshe going to find Yitro. He ends up getting married to Zipporah in the end, but the whole idea is him going to find Yitro. And if you look at the psukim, just to buttress kind of this idea that I was saying, if you look at Pasuk Tetvav, there's two segments to Moshe's flight. On the one hand, Vayivrach Moshe mipnei Paro, Moshe flees from Paro. But on the other hand, Vayeshev Eretz Mitzran, Vayeshev Al Ba'er. The root Yashav implies something permanent, right? He's looking to kind of just sit there and settle there. And Rav Moshe Lichtenstein develops a pshat that what did Yitro represent? Yitro represented this person who's trying to remove himself from history in search of God, right? Chazal darshan this all the time about Yitro. That he was a Kohen Midian who tried every single Oved Avodah Zarah, and basically his entire being was about trying to find the one truth, the one God, but not connected to history in any way. There's a famous Midrash about how Paro consulted with Bilam, Iov, and Yitro regarding how to treat the Jews. Yitro is the one person who says, I don't want to have any part in this, and he leaves. And in that sense, the Midrash is all about the same idea that Yitro is constantly the person who doesn't want to be involved in Jewish history. In fact, you can kind of see this throughout the rest of Chumash, where Yitro shows up at Har Sinai, because who wouldn't be? Who wouldn't want to be? If you're in search of God, and Hashem's giving the Torah to the Jews, like that's where you want to be, that's where God's at. Right? But then, later on in Parshat Bamidbar, in Perek Yud, when Moshe asks Yitro if he wants to continue with him to Eretz Yisrael, it's not clear what he says, but it seems like Yitro says, that's not for me. When it comes to God, search of God, that Yitro's into. But when it comes to becoming part of a history of like a nation, that's not for Yitro. And in truth, that's where Moshe is right now. Moshe, at this very moment in time, has tried to lead the rebellion. He's failed, and at this point he says, fine, you know what, I'm going to remove myself from Jewish history, try to find God on my own in the desert, being a ro'eh, maybe I'll happen upon a sneh one day, but this whole being a part of the history and leading the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, that's not for me. That's what the Midian experience is about. Now it's very interesting that the Prince of Egypt, at this point, around an hour of the movie's already passed, and there are only 40 minutes left. But if you look in Tanakh, at this point, around 2 prakim have passed, and there are around 11 prakim of the Exodus story left. What's going on here? The Tanakh apparently, or the Chumash apparently doesn't seem to care as much about the nuances of the development that Moshe goes through while he's in Midian. In fact, from year 20 to year 80, we barely know anything about Moshe. Fascinating. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein develops this in contrast to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is also a famous personality whose past we don't really know much about. But whereas with Avraham Avinu, the Midrashim really fill in the background of what Avram's youth, right? Either he was 3 when he found God, he was 40 and mature and like philosophical when he found God. When it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, unlike Avraham Avinu, Chazal don't really fill in what happened during the 60 years that Moshe was in the Midbar. And Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's shot here is that you don't need to fill in the text because, in a way, the text is already telling the story through its silence. The reason Midian isn't really talked about in the text of the Chumash is because for 60 years, Moshe did nothing but contemplate, nothing but hang out with Yitro, right? And the silence of those times almost points to the solitude with which Moshe was living his life. So in a way, the pshat of the Mikra is the fact that there are no psukim there. And in a sense, like, when it comes to making a movie, you can't really do that. And in fact, when you're making a movie, it's not good to have a person age from the years 20 to 80, the prime years of his life, right? And only start redeeming them, B'nai Israel, when he's on a cane, I mean a staff, right? When, right, the movie presents Moshe as what, like a 30-year-old? Something like that. Young and youthful, like, definitely has a capability to save B'nai Israel. How are we doing time-wise? Okay, 10 minutes. We can do this. Now, there's certain things the movie really does get right. One of them, I think, is the sne. I'm not saying God's voice. I've never heard God's voice. I don't know if he gets that right or not. But in terms of the message of the sne, I think that the movie really, really is right on. The movie starts with God saying, "Moses, Moses." And it's funny that in the movie it appears that the reason that Moses is repeated is because there's an echo going on, not necessarily because, like, they're a Chavivin or anything like that. But, in addition, the next thing that is stated in the movie are the words, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. Right? That's how God refers to himself. In the Chumash, it's a conversation. The Prince of Egypt, he just starts off with the words, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. And then he goes on to talk about how I, God, am the God of your forefathers, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Right, and really, in throughout that narrative in the movie, God really stresses the history that Moshe is connected to. And I really think that this isn't the entire Sneh experience, but that this is a major part of what the Sneh experience is about. Because if you think about it, Moshe has been waiting, I think, 60 years in the Midbar to finally find God. And now he finally follows the sheep into this random mountain. Oh wait, Har Elokim Bechorev, right? Burning bush. God appears to him, and what's he say? Moshe, you've been doing it wrong this entire time. It's not about solitude. It's about being connected to history. And if you really want to find me, then one day when you lead Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim, Tavduna Elokim Bahar Hazeh. The only time where you're really going to have a full connection with me is when you lead all of Bnei Israel out and you come back to this mountain and you become their leader. When you're removed from the people, you're not going to make that connection with God. But when you connect with the people, when you connect with your history, when you go and take Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim, then you're really going to find me. All right, 60 years, Moshe, you tried hard, but now really when life begins at the age of 80. The next thing that happens in the Prince of Egypt, fascinating, is Moshe makes his way back to Egypt. Now, here's where a lot of the major criticisms come in. He goes back with Yocheved Tzipora on the back, and Tzipora is actually there throughout the narrative. Now, we all kind of know, it's not 100% clear, but it seems like from the fact that Tzipora is only brought back to meet Moshe and Yitro, that she must have not gone through the whole Exodus experience with Moshe himself. It seems like after that famous, very ambiguous narrative at the end of Parshat Shmot, towards the end of Parshat Shmot, where Moshe goes back and they do the whole Brit Mila thing, Tzipora is sent back to Mitzrayim. I mean, sent back to Midian. That doesn't seem to be the case in the Prince of Egypt. That's probably just because it's good to have a wife at your hand when you're redeeming the Jewish people. I don't think there's anything major. Although, the Chatan Damim Lamulot thing, the whole thing about the Brit Milah that Moshe has to give before he goes into Egypt, I think is also very much connected to this concept of Moshe reconnecting to his history after being in Midian for so many years. That, right, the whole concept of Brit Milah is about connecting to the covenant, and in that sense, he has to give his son a Brit Milah before he goes in. You have a... Okay, we'll keep on going. The other thing, which is, I mean, as a Kohen, this is the thing that upsets me the most, is the fact that, you know, in the Chumash, when Moshe's going back, he meets Aaron along the way, and embrace, and at least originally in the narrative, it's really the two of them that are going to lead Bnei Israel out of Egypt. However, in the Prince of Egypt, maybe it's just because you can't have too many protagonists, Aaron's really almost like the naysayer. He almost takes the place of like Datan Vaviram throughout the text. And
Jeff Goldblum.
Fine. And it's definitely not the way that he's portrayed in Chumash. In fact, as we'll see in about 1 minute, I think the very concept of Aaron was that he was a leader of the people and Moshe was just an emissary of God. So the very concept of Aaron was that he was almost more of a shaliach in the general, like, normal leadership sense than Moshe was. Yeah.
I think Aaron was, like, the voice of the people in a certain sense, because he was the one who was actually suffering.
But not as a leader, though. He wasn't the one riling
up. Of course, not as a leader, but I'm saying, like, in terms of the movie, like, you really couldn't go through the entire wilderness journey with the people, and you couldn't really talk to any of the people.
Right.
Like, he was basically the voice of the people, as you would presume it to be, which is, like, cynical, that God has basically forgotten us, and that, like, you know, we don't know when we're going to be redeemed, and we don't know what's going on, but, like, you know, we know that we're slaves in Egypt, and it's awful, you know, and we're just cynical, and he's just, like, cynical about the world. So, like, I actually really do see that as, like, not as Aaron per se, but, like, as a legitimate...
So I think that goes back to what I mentioned beforehand. I think Aaron takes in the movie takes more of the place of Datan Vaviram character. That many times throughout Chumash, Datan Vaviram are kind of like the characters inserted as the official complainers of Israel, and the voice of the people in a sense. And I think that swap is made in the movie probably just for character issues to make the plot exciting.
Of course.
The next, I can stop me saying that line because that's kind of obvious. But there's something deeper which we'll get to. Next thing, Moshe makes it back to Egypt, right? The Sipora, we'll pretend that was the Sipora. Who's the first person he meets with in the movie? Who's he meet with first? In the movie, he meets with his brother, Ramses, prince of the pharaoh at the time. However, if you look at the beginning of, or the end of Perek Dalet, in Sefer Shemot, who are the first people that Moshe meets with? He meets with the Zakenim. Fascinating. What does this point to? What's the significance of this distinction? For a Moshe Lichtenstein, this distinction is huge. Because in Moshe's mind, originally, you have to go back to what we were saying in the beginning, when he was going back to Egypt, he wasn't going back to start an Exodus movement for the first time. He was starting his second movement, his second attempt at an Exodus. And for Moshe, this first time, he assumed that the rebellion would be stirred up, as he thought the first time, would be stirred up by the people, by the Zakenim. If you read the Perek Gimel closely, it almost sounds like Hashem has one thing in mind, and Moshe has a different plan. So Hashem says, fine, Moshe, you can try your plan. It's not going to work, and then I'm going to do what I want to do. And I don't have time to read the Parshat Va'era so closely, but if you look at the beginning of Va'era, which is a Mishnah Parsha, which I never fully understood till this week, Moshe is commanded by God twice to go back to Paro after his first failure. The first time he's commanded to go back, he's commanded to go to the people and then to bring the people with their support to Paro. So Moshe tries this. People disagree, Mikotze Ruach Me'avodah Kasha, and Moshe gives up. Then there's a weird genealogical interlude where we hear about like families of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, ending with Moshe and Aaron. And then again, Moshe is commanded by God to go to Paro, but this time, not as the emissary of the people, but as the emissary of God. At this point, the real Exodus plan is hatched. God's plan is hatched. Moshe is not leading a grassroots movement. The only thing he's doing is acting as the shaliach of Hashem neged Paro. There are ways in the text which this is developed, but I think it's a fascinating idea. And in truth, if you look throughout the Makot, I think there's really a dual purpose to the Makot. One, is God teaching a message to Paro, and the other is God teaching a lesson to the Jewish people, to have faith, to rally them behind their leader, to show them his nifla'ot. And now if you look at the movie, the major tension is not between God and Paro, but it's between Moses and Ramses, his brother. Now, I think this goes back to something we were mentioning about Midrash beforehand. What we said was that there's sometimes there are these nagging questions, right? Like, why did Moshe survive? Sometimes there are these nagging questions that kind of underlie our reading of a text that we just want answers to, and the text doesn't really provide for us. One of those questions may be, how does the fact that Moshe grew up in the palace of Paro affect the fact that he's a leader, his emotions when he's taking Bnei Israel out of Egypt, right? Does he perhaps still have anybody that he's related to in the palace? That's a major idea, right? You can't overlook the fact that Moshe was a Mitzri. It's not just that he was saved by being in a Mitzri household, he must have also been influenced by that Mitzri household. The Midrashim speak about this a little bit. The Prince of Egypt speaks about this a lot. What the Prince of Egypt is doing is almost answering that question of ours. Right? It's saying that Moshe and Ramses had this brother relationship, and it tore them apart, because on the one hand, Ramses needed to protect the traditions of Mitzrayim, and Moshe needed to gain the freedom of his people. The tension is definitely something that could have been felt in Mitzrayim. It could be a potential narrative. There's no way of knowing, but it does answer a nagging question in the back of our head. In fact, towards the end of the movie, and I'm going to skip a little bit, when Az Yashir, after the whole Kriyat Yam Suf, another one of those famous Midrashim is clearly portrayed in the movie. You know which one I'm referring to? Paro's left alive. He's yelling on the other side of the Yam Suf. He's yelling the words, Moses! Moses! Right? And while Moshe is leading everybody on the other side of the Nile to safety. In a way, this whole movie made me think about that Midrash in a new light. Right? That maybe there really is this Moshe Neged Paro narrative which is underlying the text. And in truth, there's definitely much to now look at in the pshat in terms of that narrative as well. It's not just God versus Moshe, it's not just God versus Paro, it's Moshe versus Paro as well. And this nagging question that maybe isn't dealt with as much in the Midrash, the Prince of Egypt is kind of grabbing onto. Last part, and this is the part that I heard from Rabbi Sachs surrounding Az Yashir. I mentioned before that Rabbi Sachs was one of the people who like previewed the movie, and he said that what was fascinating to him was the placement of Az Yashir in the movie Prince of Egypt. Do you remember where the songs begin?
It's before.
The songs are sung at the moment of their freedom, but the moment of their freedom occurs before the actual Kriyat Yam Suf, where Paro and his men are drowned. The Rav Sachs was convinced that this is because it doesn't look so good to start singing when everybody's being killed. And I think there's probably some truth to that. And in fact, there's one famous midrash that actually reflects that idea as well, right? The Malachim are singing Shira while the Egyptians are dying at Yam Suf. There is some type of a human element found in the midrash, in the sense that we feel bad that we had to kill the Egyptians to do this. What?
And
the Seder too. And it's also reflected in words to the famous song that I never really understood. We believe in miracles, right? And the words go, it's hard to kill. I never understood why those words, it's hard to kill, are in there. But then when I watched the movie and I understood the context, and I saw the previous scene with Moshe Rabbeinu, it all clicked for me, right? This was more like a shot in the movie, that after Moshe Rabbeinu has to do Makat B'chorot, you see him break down crying. And you see in the song too, even amidst the joy, there's also tears being shed as well. That this is what had to be done for their freedom. Now, I'm not sure how much this is actually reflected in the pshat of the text, but there definitely is that element found within Midrash, and it's definitely something interesting to think about. In terms of what the purpose of Az Yashir is, I think it's the fact that it's sung after Kriyat Yam Suf and not beforehand is perhaps reflective of when Bnei Israel actually reached their freedom.
Well,
right?
I think you can also see like, the dichotomy between like what happened, what the Jews do, and what Moshe actually does, like after Makapa Bechorot, which is during Makapa Bechorot, or after they're freed, the Jews go around, they collect, you know, they collect the gold, the silver, and all that, and Moshe goes and, you know, and gets Yosef,
right.
Meaning like he's concerned with like just the practical, you know, needs, as opposed to like the Jews who seem to be more, you know, for better or for worse, they seem to be like, as it were, rejoicing in their enemy's defeat, which is understandable concerning their, you know, concerning their circumstances. You know, like I wouldn't blame a you know, an African American slave for rejoicing in the defeat of the South.
Right.
You know, at the same so
it's a necessary evil.
Right, and so like what's interesting about like what you're saying is like, you know, the dichotomy between the human element where the Jews do sing Shira at the end, at the other side of the sea, but the angels are prevented from doing so. What are the angels? The angels are the constant moral they're supposed to be kept in a constant moral structure, as opposed to the Jews who like are affected by their like circumstances. Right? And so like who's reflected in like our actual tradition, as opposed to like who's reflected in you know who actually wins out, like which idea is the idea of God rebuffing the angels, that we don't dance on our enemies' graves, you know. But yes, like at that time it was a great thing.
Cool, I hear. Point well taken. At this point, the narrative, Prince of Egypt, kind of. Give me 2 more minutes? Okay. At this point, the narrative Prince of Egypt kind of finishes. But I want to finish the Rav Moshe Lichtenstein narrative. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, his book is on the entire story of Moshe as a leader, but this section of his book ends with Har Sinai. It says, at Har Sinai, Moshe really comes full circle. Because at Har Sinai, Moshe is really tested to see how much he's become a person of the people. Right. Bnei Israel sinned with Egel HaZahav, and now Moshe comes down and he has to deal with everything. And Hashem says, well, you know what? I'm willing to make you not only the leader of the Jewish people in terms of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, I'm willing to make you the historical leader of the Jewish people. I'm willing to destroy all the Jewish people now and start everything over again. You will be the equivalent of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And now Moshe, the person who spent 60 years of his life in solitude in Midian, thinking that finding God, the way to find God was by only being by oneself, right? That same Moshe at Har Sinai says, there's no way history is coming from me. I'm part of something called the Jewish people, and I'm willing to put my very reputation on the line to save the Jews. And what's also fascinating is that this whole dialogue is happening at the very same place, presumably, where the Sneh, where Moshe had first encountered God, where the Sinai actually first was, right? It's Har Sinai, with also it's covered with fire, and that the parallels are endless. But it's incredible that here now Moshe, just like Hashem had promised him, right? And in Paragimel, Tavduna Telokim Baharazeh, Moshe has now come back. He's come and he's really served God, and he's served God through being one with the people. And come full circle in terms of becoming not only leader of the Jewish people, but part of the history of the Jewish people. Fine. So with that, why in the world did I do all of this? It was fun, right? But in essence, what we've done, is we've told over 2 narratives. We've told over, as I said in the beginning, the Prince of Egypt narrative, and we've told over the Rav Moshe Lichtenstein narrative. And what's fascinating is, I think they're both almost equally midrash. In a sense, when it comes to interpreting the text, there's the point where you just are trying to find the text, what its actual meaning is in terms of the words, or creating structural parallels between different paragraphs. When it comes to putting the entire narrative together, when it comes to asking all those questions that aren't necessarily addressed in the Mikra, right? The questions such as, why did Moshe survive? Or is there any significance to Moshe coming from an Egyptian household, right? Did Moshe lead a rebellion previously? Right? These are questions that we ask, but the text doesn't really provide answers for. And in creating a narrative, both the Prince of Egypt and Moshe Lichtenstein are in a way practicing the same thing. They're practicing the concept of Midrash. They're making Torah into what is really meant to be read as, not history, but as literature, which has the ability to provide numerous meanings to those who really look into it. That's one. Concept of Midrash being literature in the sense that the reader has to really piece points of the narrative together and be aware of those nagging questions. Takeaway number two is I really thought the parallel of watching the movie and then following that up with asking my own questions on the text is a very helpful way to learn Torah in general. The title is technically Pshutel Shel Mikra. I think one of the biggest problems in the study of Tanakh nowadays is that we're kind of in like a post-Rev Breuer world where people now kind of think that they're too good for Mefarshim and just want to read the Pshat of Tanakh. Just give me the text. I don't want anything else, right? I think doing this really demonstrates why it's so important to read Mefarshim. One of the reasons, other than that these are traditional interpretations of the text, but I think one of the reasons it's so important to read Mefarshim is because there are questions that you just don't ask until you hear or read somebody else's thoughts. Even if that's a movie, right? You watch the movie and it opens you up to a whole new world of questions on Egypt. You read Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's text, it opens you up to a whole new world of questions on Mikra. And I think that's part of the importance of reading Mefarshim and Tanakh is that it brings you to ask questions. And my last and final thought, I'm sorry, I just really enjoyed this. The last and final thought is the following. There's a famous essay by a Professor Orbach. Quoted in the Chama Leibowitz, who I read it the first time, he contrasts the writing of Homer and Akedat Yitzchak. And definitely heavily recommended. But the basic idea is that Homer is incredibly illustrative, describes every single detail, how old everybody was, the feelings everybody had at every single moment in time, whereas Akedat Yitzchak is extremely devoid of emotion. Right? You don't know how old people are, you don't necessarily know what Avram's feeling, you definitely don't know what Yitzchak is feeling. Right? And his basic idea is, his basic thesis is, following that the reason that the Tanakh narrative is done this way is to open up the reader to question. I think that's the idea of Chumash in general and why it's so important to do things like this in general as well. It's important to read Mefarshim because it opens you up to what study of Chumash is supposed to be. The story is not there until you create it. You have to create the narrative. You have to put the story together. You have to create a Prince of Egypt. You have to create a Moshe Lichtenstein story. And the only way you could do that is through asking questions and realizing that the text doesn't provide everything that you need to really complete the entire narrative. I think it's a very relevant message for the Seder that we're about to start. Last pshat is that it always bothered me that during the Seder, the actual telling of the story is done through Midrash. Right, there's a bunch. The real telling of the story is done based of Arami Overavi, and we darshim sukim based of Arami Overavi regarding basically taking us through the entire Yitzhak Yisrael story. I always said, like, why don't we just read the narrative? Why don't we just read from Shmot Aleph to Shmot Yudalit? But I think the very idea of doing the drash in, and this may be a little bit of drush, but the very idea of doing drash at that point in the Seder, for the actual concept of Sipur Yitzhak Mitzrayim, is because to tell the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, you have to be engaged in Jerush. You have to be engaged in asking those deep and penetrating questions that really underlie the text. to really tie the narrative together, to make the story whole. And that is the end of the shiur. Way too long, I'm sorry about that.